copy.
That particular instrument is not very well covered at the bachelor level in most of the electrical engineering schools that I know about. That particular instrument very rarely appears on the flea market or on the eBay, so getting a hold of a TDR at attractive prices is a bit difficult. If you shop around, you'll eventually find one. If, for instance, you were a member of something like the Microwave Reflector Listserv group, and you pass the word around that among that group of people, I'm looking for a time domain reflectometer, within a month, somebody in one of those 50 countries that are covered by those 300 guys is going to find that thing for you, particularly if he's got faith in your particular operation. The actual theory of operation of a time domain reflectometer is not rocket science. You could homebrew it once you understand the theory. There are a couple of very nice application notes by Hewlett-Packard application notes on time domain reflectometry usage. And they explain the theory of operation, show you block diagrams of how it works. It really is a small radar system in a coax cable. That's what a TDR is. A real radar issues a brief pulse of RF energy, it goes out into space, it reflects off an airplane, the echo off the airplane comes back to the antenna, and it appears on the radar receiver on the screen of the plant position indicator. Well, a time domain reflectometer, instead of sending out that pulse into space, it sends it down the cable. And if the cable is 50 ohms, perfect everywhere, the pulse goes down the cable and never comes back. If there's the most minor perturbation somewhere in that cable, a little bit of extra inductance, a little bit of extra capacitance, a pinch in the cable, a little bit of extra stretch in the cable, a straight pin that somebody started injecting into the cable, he's 1% of the way penetrating, but he's made a minor perturbation, the TDR properly set will find anything that differs from perfect 50 ohms DC to light in that cable or on the terminations of the cable. So it's a very sensitive system. It's a radar inside of the cable. Once you understand that, homebrewing it is not out of the question. And there's ways by way of computer programs where you can simulate the pulses just by making amplitude and phase measurements across a band of frequencies in digital steps in the frequency. It's called the Steinhelfer technique. S-T-E-I-N-H-E-L-F-F-E-R, I think is the spelling. The Steinhelfer technique by way of a digital computer program just by making amplitude and phase measurements of signals you send down the cable can do a simulation of a TDR with higher resolution than you could possibly build. A good Steinhelfer technique system can resolve all perturbations in that cable probably to the nearest 16th of an inch. Whereas if you... Whereas if you try to do direct TDR techniques, and to get resolution beyond a couple of inches is difficult. But by the Steinhelfer expedient to doing TDR, you can get down to a 16th of an inch if you really wanted that. You could literally look at the individual components inside of the connector that's on the end of your cable. You could resolve the collet, the nut, the center conductor pin where it's soldered down, and whatever. Steinhelfer will allow you to do that. And so it's interesting what kind of resolution you can get with modern instrumentation. Okay, has anyone got any further questions and comments on what has happened so far? Speak up now. Give me your call letters and name. KQLIW in the TechNet.
K2KEY again.
Well, the technique applies. And good evening, Nick. It's Gordon.
K2KEY.
Yeah, somehow I completely forgot about Gordon. You got skipped. We got to come back to you. Mel first. Go ahead, Mel.
Okay, as far as the switches go, I can say there's a company, I have to remember, I was involved with something like that a few years ago, and I remember the name of the company that handled all kinds of versions of the switches. I think they were made by Fairchild. Pastanac, P-A-S-T-R-N-A-C-K Enterprises, Irving, California, Dick. And, yeah, you look in the handbook. They show you a simple way of bringing up a TDR system in the ARRL, you know, amateur radio handbook, Dick, over.
I guess I wasn't smart enough to find that. I didn't know the amateur radio handbook had a TDR section. If so, that's a very good beginning. And also, there are some beautiful tech notes by Hewlett-Packard. And if you just Google the word time domain reflectometer, guaranteed there's a Wikipedia nice section. I'll bet you'll get 1,000 hits on Google if you search on the word time domain reflectometry, time domain reflectometer, time to reflectometry measurement techniques, and so on. Fascinating subject. Some of the best measurements I've ever made. Well, the measurement that gave me the most amount of accolades, awards from both the IEEE and from the company I was working for at the time, was where I had set up a TDR, not inside of a cable, but in free space. I literally made a radar that could resolve in range to the nearest 3 inches. And I did it inside of the world's largest anechoic chamber, the Benfield Anechoic Facility at Edwards Air Force Base. And I was able to find every nail and every adapter and whatever that had been dropped onto the anechoic material that was on the floor of this 1 acre floor space chamber. A little bit less than 1 acre. I could find all of the perturbations in that chamber by setting up a kind of a TDR. I called it spatial time domain reflectometry. You could call it an extremely high resolution radar if you like, but rarely can a radar resolve every 3 inches in space what's going on. And by very brief RF pulsing, I was able to do that. And I made some, what to me were breakthroughs in how brief an RF pulse can you make. I was building a pulse generator that made pulses 250 picoseconds long, a quarter of a nanosecond. At the speed of light, the signal only gets a chance to move 3 inches during the pulse. I was doing this at X-band. Each individual pulse consisted of 3 cycles of a 10 gigahertz signal. That was the whole darn pulse. And I was doing that at the multiple 100-watt level. Beautiful piece of instrumentation. Boy, does that thing have resolution. Get into that another time. Let's see. Gordon, sorry we skipped over you. KC2, QIQ, go right ahead, sir. K2RIW, TechNet, and give us enough audio. Sometimes you speak a little softly.
Is this the other Gordon, WSU, TCG?
Oh. Maybe I've got Mr. QIQ. He signed in, he had a yes, and I skipped over him. And I better get to him first before I get to the other Gordon, TCG. And by the way, a quick one on TTT. Have you seen the March issue of CQ Magazine?
I did. I saw the Zero Bias column. Congratulations, Dick. We seem to be rock stars in our own delusional world. I wanted if you could just give me that sneak again, the TDR, and this one set that up.
Okay, again, if you Google the word Steinhelfer, the fancy computer generation technique for making an extremely high-resolution time-domain reflectometer is called Steinhelfer. And I may not have the spelling exactly right, but it's very close to S-T-E-I-N-H-E-L-F-F-E-R, Steinhelfer. Steinhelfer did his work, his most breakthrough work, in the late 60s and early 70s. And so there's a zillion articles on the subject. If you have trouble finding them, I have a list of references because I've used his articles when I was doing that work at Edwards Air Force Base. So Steinhelfer is what you're looking for, and call it a advanced high-resolution version of time-domain reflectometry. QRZ on that one, Gordon, go ahead.
Yeah, no problem. I got it. Thank you, Steinhelfer. I'll go look it up when I get home. Thank you, Dick, and I'm just coming home from a dinner. That was a ham radio club dinner, in fact. So, just that Ridge Radio Club. So, my family and I are on our way home, and thank you for that. And you can go on to the other station who, I guess, we crossed Gordon's or something. K2RIW, WU2TT.
Okay, good luck with that research. Gordon, number one, KC2, QIQ. Go right ahead, sir. Sorry we skipped over you. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, very good, Dick. Name is Glenn, by the way, too. It's not Gordon. That's why I was starting to get a little bit confused there. But I just adjusted the audio level here. Is this an acceptable level? Or?
Very good level. And you've been speaking rather soft over the last few weeks. That's just about right. I'll leave it right there and step up to the mic, Glenn. Sorry about that. I keep confusing your name.
Okay, very good, Dick. I've been working on a 10 gigahertz sideband station, assembling parts, trying to put them together. And basically, I'm having issues, I guess, with the antennas right now, just ordering parts and trying to figure out what I want to do. So I've decided on two antennas. The first one is a horn, and I was looking at using a WR90 waveguide and also a WR90 adapter to type in, you know, for the 10 gigahertz X-band. And then use a horn that'll give me about 20 dB gain. So far, this seems to be the simplest antenna that I can put together first, and it looks like that one will probably be the least amount of trouble. The second antenna I'm working on is a dish where I'm using a direct TV offset dish where basically I'm going to be pointing an antenna at the dish and then reflecting off the dish. And the question now is I'm trying to determine what do I want to use as the antenna pointing at the dish. Now, I can get a lot of the WR90 waveguide, I can get the adapter from Type N, but now, what's the best thing to put at the end of the waveguide? Can the waveguide be used with something on the end, obviously a horn that's going to have 20 dB gain is obviously not the right choice to put on the end. But I've seen a lot of different variations where people are using waveguides, and then they do something to terminate at the end before they focus it at the dish in order to get the correct focal length. Maybe you can help me out in that area, because I'm really not sure what happens to the waveguide when nothing's attached on the other side.
Okay, one of my favorite subjects, Glenn, and I was on 10 gigahertz for about a 6-year period. My antenna got damaged, and I've got to replace it and put it all back up again. Although, in the process, I added some more power, so there was a blessing in disguise. I've talked to people on 10 states, on 10 gigahertz single sideband narrowband technique, never using more than 0.2 watts, 200 milliwatts, all solid state. And my 200 milliwatt rig was put into a box behind a 2-foot dish on the top of the front of Fiddle Tower. A horn is a very good beginning, very similar to what happens when a person first gets into astronomy. A set of binoculars, a good set of binoculars, but the right way of mounting it, give you a lot of pleasure in a small amount of time. As you get more and more serious, you eventually trade up, so to speak, from the binoculars to a good microscope. Starting off on 10 gigs with a horn antenna is a very foolproof technique. And the waveguide, the coax adapter, even if it's expensive, homebrewing is not too difficult if you're a little bit crafty. And the horn itself can be made out of copper clad, galvanized steel, copper sheet. There's all kinds of ways of making the horn if you want to. When you step up the next step beyond the 15 to 22 dB of gain that is easy to get out of the horn, the next step is a parabolic dish. You don't build Yagis on 10 gigs. You don't build dipoles, per se, as a serious antenna. It's a real aperture band. In other words, some kind of an object with area to it, either a big horn or a parabolic dish. One of the most popular antennas is the 18-inch diameter direct broadcast satellite type of dish. Is one of the most popular kind of antennas on that band. You'll get some hints about construction techniques and how people have done it, pictures, and how they've portabilized them with tripods on top of mountains and at beachfronts and whatever by going to the Tom Williams website, WhiskeyAlpha1MikeBravoAlpha.com. WhiskeyAlpha1MikeBravoAlpha.com. You go to Tom Williams' website. It gives you a beautiful introduction to the 10 gig band. It's got all kinds of articles and references and whatever, and pictures of people doing it. You'll eventually be referred to the online book by W1 Gigahertz. All of a sudden I'm having trouble thinking of Paul Wade. Paul Wade has an online book. On his online book, he'll show you how to homebrew the horn, which is appropriate for putting it in front of an 18-inch direct broadcast offset-fed parabolic dish. Very nice antenna. When you put a horn in front of a parabolic dish, depending on the focal length, the diameter ratio of the dish, there is an ideal beamwidth of horn, which will just properly illuminate that dish
you're trying to evenly smear the power across the dish and not waste too much filling over the side. And if you had too high a gain horn, you would be creating a hot spot in the center of the dish, and the perimeter of the dish you wouldn't be using at all. So there's an ideal horn for each dish depending on its focal length to diameter ratio. Most of these offset fed dishes have an F over D of something like 0.7. So the horn that's appropriate for 0.7, you'll find a bunch of suggestions with all kinds of curves and methods of construction and whatever in the W1 gigahertz website that you'll find on the W1 MBA website. The online book is what I'm talking about of Paul Wade. So you'll be amazed how much information there is there. You'll eventually be joining Tom Williams' listserv where the guys that are using 10 gigs and above or 2 gigs and above talk to each other on a daily basis. And there's all kinds of traffic going back and forth as they're looking for components and looking for brick oscillators and mixers and combining various combinations that work and don't work and setting up automatic noise figure indicators and breaking distance records at frequencies like 243 gigahertz and so on. Interesting material. And I'm hoping to get my... Let me drop. I'm hoping to get my 10 gig system back into operation. And between you and I over there to Massapequa would be an extremely easy haul. You would be really blasting to each other. As you probably know, you just go to QRZ.com and look up KQRIW and look at the printed section there, and you'll see where Bruce, N2LIV, and KQRIW used to have an extremely active group that called themselves the 10X group on Long Island. Well, my antenna got damaged in the wind. Bruce got busy with a couple of other things. We think we were the spark plug for those 10 guys, and those 10 guys became less active. Well, it's time that Bruce and I get back into activity. He's been constructing antennas. I've been constructing towers. It's time I put my antenna back up on there. So I'd like to believe that help is on the way and you'll not be alone on that band. And you've done the right thing if you're pursuing narrow band versus wide band. Wide band is quick and dirty. It gets you on the band in a hurry with a gun flexor. But when it comes to real long range stuff, nice clean audio and whatever, the narrow band technique by sending out single sideband on that band can't be beat. It gives you 25 or 30 dB extra sensitivity compared to the gun flexor approach, and ultimately you can produce a heck of a lot more high power with it, in my opinion. So maybe some of those informations will help you, and you'll have, as you construct this thing and you find out what works and what doesn't work, you'll have a bunch of questions. There's one more thing I'm going to tell you. Let me drop one more time. Bruce and I did a whole bunch of experiments with 3/4 inch water pipes that you buy out of Home Depot. 3/4 inch round water pipe makes the world's most beautiful waveguide, lower in loft than mill-specified, silver-plated WR90 waveguide. 3/4 inch water pipe that you get out of Home Depot has lower insertion loss. That's the good news. And then the more good news is that the 45-degree elbows, the 90-degree elbows, the adapters from 3/4 inch to 1.5 inch and whatever, make feed horns and so on. You'd be amazed how many microwave components exist on those shelves at Home Depot and the Lowe's, you know, all of these stores that sell plumbing products. You go walking up and down those aisles with your RFI, your microwave eye well-tuned, you'll be amazed how many components that you see. So we have found ways of building a button hook, what we call it, feed horn assembly for our dishes, and there's a version of that you can build for the offset fed 18-inch dish or the 24-inch dish. So round waveguide has got a lot going for it. The disadvantage is it doesn't have as wide a frequency range over which it works properly, but you're only going to use 10.368 plus or minus a few megacycles of the 500 megs of that bandwidth that we're allotted. The hams are allowed to use 10.0 to 10.5 gigahertz. That ham band is 500 megahertz wide. Boy, you can rattle around in there and do all kinds of fancy experiments legally with 1,500 watts of peak envelope power output if you've got the smarts to and the deepest pockets to do it. What a ham band that is. And my best DX on that band is 380 miles down to Cape Hatteras, North Carolina. And that guy was 20 dB out of my noise, and he was running a 1-watt transmitter. that's another whole story. So I think you're going to have quite a bit of fun with the band. If you are all by yourself, it's limited in fun. You can still do a lot of things by reflecting signals off the wall and listening to the Doppler shift and so on. But when you've got other people to talk to, and you reflect signals off of clouds and off the World Trade Center when it used to be there, or now the Empire State Building, you're about to find out that that band is very different than the bands you've used up till now. AT2QIQ, A2RIW, you got it, Glenn.
Yeah, definitely. Thanks for the input, Dick. This is something I've been looking at for a while, and every time there's an answer, it opens up two more questions. I guess what really the next question is now is, if I'm looking at, like, the WR90 waveguide, and I understand, okay, you can terminate one end to 50 ohms, and you can put the horn on the other end, and basically you can get the match and the pipe end down to 50 ohms with coax, but the characteristic impedance of the WR90 waveguide isn't going to be 50 ohms. It's going to be something else. And that aperture that's open where it goes into the feed horn on the other side, if that's left open, what does that do to the VF-54 on the type N sector on the other end? So I believe, at least my understanding, correct me if I'm wrong, I'm thinking that what the horn is actually doing is it's basically focusing the signal to improve, like, its directivity in one direction, or set that its directivity, and basically the cross-sectional area of, let's say, 0.9 inches by 0.04 is going to set the polarization from vertical to horizontal. Basically, when that square aperture, that rectangular aperture, is in the vertical position, it's actually horizontally polarized, and when it's in the horizontal, mechanically horizontal, basically it's in the vertical polarization. So I kind of understand all that, but I guess what it's just not clear is that if you don't have a horn on the end of a waveguide, what is that actually doing to the VFWR on that type N connector on the other end?
Don, good question. And the difference, the answer is very different than common sense. You and I know that if I was setting up waveguide correctly, and I'm bringing two pieces of waveguide together, we would like the waveguide to be shiny, smooth, silver-plated. We would like the joint where you bolt the two pieces of waveguide together to be such a fine crack that if you looked at it with a microscope, you wouldn't see anything. That's what you think is required for good waveguide propagation. Now let's get down to reality. If I take a chunk of waveguide that's got a waveguide to coax adapter at one end, and I've launched the signal properly down the guide, and there used to be a dummy load at the far end or a piece of equipment at the far end, and I take out my hacksaw, and I hack open the middle of the waveguide, just hacksaw right through it at right angles, and I open it to space, you would think you'd be getting the biggest reflection in the world. Uh-oh, a signal will come squirting out of there, and 90-some-odd percent of it will go radiating into space. You open up a piece of waveguide, and you'll end up with an antenna that has approximately a 1.5 standing wave ratio. Particularly if there's a flange on the end. The hacksaw experiment, maybe I'd get a 1.8 standing wave ratio. But with the flange on the end of the waveguide, I don't connect it to the next piece of waveguide, I just squirt it into the air. It's a 1.5 standing wave ratio antenna. In fact, the waveguide to coax adapter itself represents a beautiful sniffer. If I had a transmitter that's leaking some signal somewhere and I wanted to find out where it is, I would connect a spectrum analyzer to the waveguide to coax adapter, with the waveguide coax adapter open circuited into air. And I would just simply hold it near all of the joints that I'm suspicious of and find out which one is leaking. It's a beautiful sniffer. The waveguide itself has something like a 200 ohm impedance, and free space is something like a 377 ohm impedance. You could say that's where the 1.5 standing wave ratio is coming from. The exact impedance of the waveguide, you almost don't have to worry about it. Everybody in the beginning does worry about it. You don't. The RF energy ain't that smart. It goes down that guide, and by the way, what the signal is doing when it goes down the guide is it's bouncing back and forth between the narrow walls, not the broad walls. It's a vertically polarized signal, and if I've got the waveguide laying flat on the table, broadside down, the signal is zigzagging left and right across the narrow walls with vertical polarization. And it's a scissor zigzag. In other words, let me drop. In other words, the signal just doesn't zigzag only to the left and to the right. at the point of launching, the probe on your waveguide to coax adapter is launching a signal that zigzags to the left and zigzags to the right simultaneously. So the signal going down, the signal looks like a set of scissors repeated, you know, the scissors opened a little bit, and a step and repeat all the way down the guide. Depending on the frequency that you're using, which really means wavelength, depending on the dimensions of your particular waveguide, there is an exact angle of all of those bounces, and no other angle is allowed. For each individual wavelength, there is an exact angle of bounce, where all of the bounces come out co-phase. That's the craziness of waveguides. That's the so-called dominant mode. The horn at the end is really just taking that signal that would have been squirted into space by the end of the flange on the waveguide, and it's slowly impedance matching it to a larger emitting aperture. That's where the gain comes from. Gain is area. So you're creating a larger area. That's what the tapered sides of that horn are doing. It's just slowly launching that signal to a larger area, and therefore it's got higher directivity and higher gain. You could, if you want to, look at it as a slow impedance match between the small 9/10 of an inch wide waveguide and, let's say, the 4-inch wide mouth of your horn. It's a slow impedance match between the two, giving you a better impedance match into space. That sort of works. Not exactly true. It's simplistic, but it's one way of looking at it. Another way of looking at it is you're slowly tapering the signal into a larger aperture so that it has higher directivity. And the horn itself doesn't have to have an exactly square or rectangular mouth to it. You can start off with whatever dimension in the throat area you want, round, rectangular, square, where you launch the signal in the waveguide to coax adapter. The waveguide itself doesn't have to be rectangular. It could be round or square. It could even be rectangular in the wrong dimension, as long as it's big enough. And then the horn itself doesn't have to taper equally horizontal as well as vertically. You can make the mouth of the horn wider in one dimension and narrow in the other if you want to control the beam width differently, horizontally versus vertical. And if you're smart enough, you can make that all work. And if you go one step smarter yet, at the mouth of the horn, you can put a dielectric object of the right shape, which is called a lens, which can give you a little bit better focusing yet, and a little bit better aperture distribution, and a little bit better phase taper. So you'd be amazed, everything that you do on X-band, how quasi-optical it is. An awful lot of what you do has an optical equivalent to setting up lenses on a telescope. You'd be amazed how similar it is. A cassegrain telescope and a cassegrain antenna system are almost the identical object. Just the wavelengths and the sizes are a little bit different. It's a fun area to experiment with, Glenn. Casey,
repeater, timeout,
cancel. KC2, QIQ. Make sure you let it drop long enough to reset the timer. KQLIW, you got it, Glenn.
Okay, thanks, Dick. I'm actually, that's my two last questions now. The last two are basically, the idea behind the two antennas, one is to use the horn into a spectrum analyzer. Because right now, so that I can get a very good price on the VR90, the type N adapter, and the horn that's kind of like commercially available. And it's like under $100, so it almost doesn't even make sense for something that sort of calibrates wideband and ready to go with 20 dB gain, and it's almost calibrated in test equipment to use that into a spectrum analyzer to measure the efficiency of my dish. But I guess now here's the next crazy question, is that when I'm focusing the antenna at the dish and I'm trying to get it to reflect off, when I'm looking at polarization, like DirecTV, when they did theirs, they used circular polarization, but I don't think that's really what I'm looking for here, right? I'm still looking for either a horizontal or a vertical positioning, whether, you know, you're Europe or the United States. But is it critical how I focus the waveguide and the lens at the dish to set up a vertical or a horizontal polarization?
It's sort of a yes and a no to that one. First of all, on the East Coast of the United States, 99% of the guides on narrowband FM are strictly horizontal polarized. There's a slight disadvantage in that. When it comes to rain scatter, we'd be way ahead of the game if we use vertical, but we've all sort of set a standard as horizontal. A higher percentage of guys on the West Coast are running vertical, and you all know who they are. When they're on top of the mountain and on the liaison frequency, 146.260, 144.260, they talk to each other on liaison saying, okay, I'm ready to roll, I'm on mountain so-and-so, and the guy on mountain such-and-such will talk back to him saying, yeah, I'm aimed at you right now. Shift me a send me a vertically polarized signal, and we'll work each other, and that'll be a contest point in this contest. And so they sometimes use vertical. Almost everybody here uses horizontal. Circular polarization is used on DirecTV for a very different reason, frequency reuse. The frequency band of which all those 32 channels of satellite reproduced transponder signals, or your geosynchronous satellites, are reproducing that signal for DirecTV, and all of the odd channels are clockwise, all of the even channels are counterclockwise, and each of the channels are half overlapped. So in other words, between channel 1 and channel 3, which are both horizontal, the upper edge of channel 1 and the lower edge of channel 3 of direct television touch each other in frequency. Channel 2, the center frequency, is right at the transition between 1 and 3, complete overlap. They can get away with that because the even channels are horizontal and the odd channels are vertical, or vice versa. So they're using circular polarization in order to get this frequency reuse phenomena because they weren't given enough bandwidth, you could say, and they want to ram a whole lot of channels in there. Most of the ham radio operators, except for a couple of very serious moon bouncers, most of the 10 gig ham radio operators are narrowband FM, 10.368 megacycles, which, by the way, is the 72nd harmonica 144 megs. That's where that frequency came from. They're all using linear polarization horizontal. A couple of the moon bouncers have experimented with circular on 10 gigs with limited success, and that's another whole story. So don't worry about the polarization. Horizontal is it. Use a horizontally polarized horn and put the horn in the right position at the focal point of that offset parabolic dish, and what comes out of the dish will again be horizontally polarized. No sweat on that one. But now finding the right focal point is a little bit of a mystery. If you know where the original low noise block converter horn was on the original DirecTV antenna, you put your horn in the exact same phase center and you're in like Flynn, no sweat. If somebody hands you the dish and the hardware for supporting the horn is not there and you have to find the focal point, life's a little bit more complicated. Don't worry, you're not going to crash and burn. If you put it in the wrong spot, it's not going to explode, it's not going to catch on fire. Nothing bad happens. You just don't get full performance. By way of making sun noise measurements, gain measurements, pattern measurements, whatever, you'll find out. By way of measuring the diameter horizontally and vertically of the reflecting surface and the depth of the dish, the so-called sagitta, goes to some mathematical formulas that will predict for you where the focal point is. And in the case of an offset-fed dish, the average guy at first says, how do I know where the damn thing is aimed? I'll give you a secret. The secret is that the offset-fed dish, the parabolic reflector itself, is a section of the parent reflector. Parent reflector means the whole reflector, if it was there, with the horn in the center, a center-fed parabolic reflector, a so-called prime-fed parabolic dish assembly, is what you could have built, and then you cut away all of the sheet metal so that only the offset center, offset section is left over. Well, the well-kept secret that you won't read in any book, and it's true 98% of the time, is that the apex of the parent reflector and the apex of the offset fed reflector are both always there. In other words, the lower edge of the offset fed reflector, the thing that you've got, is the center of the parabolic dish. Therefore, if you want to aim the dish at the horizon, the offset fed antenna system, you draw a beeline between the lower edge of the parabolic reflector and the phase center of the horn. That is...
Repeater, timeout.
So once again, the lower edge of the dish... The lower edge of the dish and a beeline through the phase center of the horn that's feeding it, that is the bore sight. You can set up a telescopic sight on that if you wanted to. So therefore, once you learn this trick, you can look at anybody's dish sitting on his tripod and you'll know right away, is it aimed up in the air or is it aimed at the horizon? If you could draw a a horizontal line parallel to the ground that sweeps to the lower ridge of dish and right through the center of his horn. He's aimed at the horizon. Wonder if that all made sense, Glenn. KT2QIQ, KQLIW in the second head.
Oh, absolutely, Dick. It definitely does. And I guess what I've been, the next question is, okay, if I can get the horn, and the horn's basically already figured out, and I have that connected up to the spectrum analyzer, let's say if I set it some distance, maybe about 10, 15 feet away from the dish, and as I'm positioning the dish, can I use that spectrum analyzer to peak and look for the peak adjustment at like some small distance, like 10, 15 feet away or so, to try to get the, you know, because I'll know which that the horn is in, let's say, from its horizontal polarization, just by physically looking at it almost. But if I start pointing the horn at the dish, when I'm doing trying to optimize the waveguide towards the dish, will that give me basically a good reference point to understand when I'm getting everything in the correct geometry?
A little bit of delay here because I'm doing a calculation. Boy, you're going to get an eye-opener. There's something called near-field range, Rayleigh distance, Fresnel zone versus Fraunhofer zone. Fancy words, what they all mean, whether it be your telescope or your parabolic dish antenna. There's a certain minimum range at which you can properly measure the pattern in the gain. And the formula for that is 2D squared over lambda. Diameter of the dish in its maximum dimension squared times 2 divided by the wavelength. You do that on an 18-inch dish, and the near-field range is 54 feet. You make a measurement of that dish closer than 54 feet, and all of that parabolic surface is not in focus simultaneously. You'll get a gain measurement. You'll get a pattern measurement. The pattern will be slightly distorted. The gain will be slightly pessimistic. You've got to be 54 feet or greater. In the case of my 3-foot dish, I think the answer came out something like 94 feet is the minimum distance at which I can really measure the gain and pattern correctly. What many of us do, if we don't have the ability to calculate where the focal point should be, and by the way, if you get the focal point a little bit wrong, a little bit too close to a little bit too far, a little bit wrong in azimuth or a little bit wrong in elevation, as I said, nothing really bad happens. But what the average guy does to peak up the gain of the dish is to use a point source object of noise, a transmitter of noise, that's at infinity. It's called the sun. You aim the dish at the sun, and you fiddle with the horn until you maximize the sun noise. And when I say sun noise, I really mean Y factor of sun noise. You aim the dish at the sun, you take a reading. You aim the dish a little bit off to the sun at cold sky, and you take a reading. And when you make that ratio of those two readings as large as possible, you peak the gain. So that's a point source of signal at infinity. Very handy at times. And if you've got a good low noise preamplifier, you'll get the 5 or 10 dB of sun noise. And that's a pretty easy measurement to make. But if you want to set it up with a real signal generator on your 18-inch dish, make that signal generator 54 feet away because of this 2D squared over lambda. Minor little difference. If you're setting up an antenna range and measuring a whole bunch of these dishes, as in I've been involved in some of the 10 gig antenna range measurements done by the Northeast Weak Signal Society News Group. Once a year, they hold a shootout of antennas who can measure the weakest signal, and they usually set up that antenna range something like 150 feet, 200 feet long. Back to you, Glenn. KT2QIQ, KQLIW in the second head.
Thanks, Dick. I think I'm very, very close to actually purchasing some hardware now to get these antennas rolling. I guess just one other quick question. Let's see. At the end of the waveguide, how much gain should I really be looking for to point at the dish? Is there some kind of like optimum gain other than just, you know, positioning and the way that I want the signal to disperse towards the dish?
Absolutely. For every dish which has a certain depth to it, or you could say a certain focal length to diameter ratio, same way of putting it mathematically, there is an ideal beamwidth of the feed horn, horizontally and vertically. If you choose that feed horn, which has the right gain number, such that the edge of the dish is 10 dB down in the primary pattern. In other words, you take the pattern of your feed horn, including the extra distance to the perimeter of the dish versus the center of the dish. The horn is going to be aimed at the center of your dish, even though it's offset fed, the center of the physical dish that you see. And if you can set it up in such a way that the gain falls off from the primary pattern of the horn, so that the signal hitting the center of the dish is 10 dB stronger than the signal hitting the perimeter of the dish, you achieve that, and you have approximately maximized the gain. If you want to maximize the gain to temperature ratio, you make that edge taper 20 dB instead of 10 dB. And in other words, you've got a slightly higher gain feed horn, creating a hotter center and a colder edge. You end up with less noise of the background, so to speak, which you sacrifice a little bit of gain in the process. But the average ham wants to maximize the gain, and the 10 dB amplitude taper is what you're looking for. The good news is that's not an extremely sharp measurement. If you made the edge taper anywhere between minus 8 and minus 12 dB, you're in the ballpark. You're going to get 98% of the performance you're going to get. Maximum gain out of the dish occurs with average dishes of this size. Maximum gain occurs with 10 dB amplitude taper and as close to 0 degrees of phase taper as you can get. And there are ways of making the horn a so-called chaparral horn. If you actually look at the inner construction, let me drop, of the low noise block down converter that originally was on your 10 gig, your direct TV antenna. If you really take apart the plastic radome on the front and you look down that horn, you'll see that it's not just a simple round tapered horn. It's got a bunch of ridges to it. It's got a bunch of chokes to it. That's in order to control the amplitude taper and phase taper to maximize the gain. And there are ham operators that will build a version of that horn for that dish. In fact, if you took the original horn and cut it away and put your own round waveguide to coax adapter on it, you would be exactly at the optimum horn for that dish, because the 10.368 is very close to the exact same frequency that's used by the satellite system. Their frequency, as I remember, is a little bit higher. Yes, it is, a little bit higher. But it's close enough. That so-called chaparral horn that they use is nearly ideal. And those extra ridges for that chaparral versus a simple tapered-sized horn gives you a little bit better amplitude control and phase control. Now, the reason I said hour-sized dishes is that if I was building a ground station for X-band service to a satellite, and I'm building a dish that's 25 feet in diameter, and now I've got 250 wavelengths to play with, as opposed to the 18 wavelengths you and I would have. When you got all those extra wavelengths to play with, now you can do other very fancy mathematical things of making the parabolic shape a little bit distorted from parabolic, and the subreflector, if you're using one, a little bit distorted from hyperbolic, and the horn itself a little bit distorted. When you put this all back together, you end up with a more uniform amplitude taper and a more uniform phase taper, and the normal 60% aperture efficiency of the antenna system can go up to 75 and 80%. Well, we don't have all of those hundreds of wavelengths to play with. We don't have that ability. And by the way, don't even consider a Cassegrain. You'd be amazed how many brand new guys on 10 gigs say, gee, that Cassegrain antenna, boy, that looks pretty, with a horn behind the dish, shooting through the dish. I'd like to build one of those. And the answer is, don't even consider a Cassegrain unless the subreflector is in at least 10 wavelengths in diameter. And there's a whole bunch of optical reasons why you have to obey those particular rules of thumb. Back to you, Glenn. KT2QIQ, K2RAW in the DECnet.
K2RAW, KT2QIQ. No, thanks, Vic. Interesting thing that you brought up, though. I did take apart the L&D from DirecTV, and I noticed inside there that when I pulled the plastic cone off and I looked inside, and I saw the small dipole, dual dipole hole mounted at the bottom, and then there was that ridge that was basically down the center of that tube. Now, if I were to take the WR90 waveguide and chain it so that I could fit the other end on, that's a circular opening going into the horizontal opening. Is there some position between those nudges and what steps that are inside that circular tube, as opposed to the eighth dimension of 0.9 by 0.4, if that should be positioned against when I put it against the flange?
Yeah, I'm going to let you in on a couple of secrets, Glenn. On a couple of occasions, I had a WR90 waveguide to coax adapter. I had to feed it into a piece of WR75 waveguide in one case. I had to feed it into a piece of WR112 waveguide in another case. And of course, I could, if I had enough time, I could slowly machine a slow taper between those waveguide sizes so the signal slowly launches from one to the other. If you just take those two waveguide flanges that are drastically different looking from each other, and you put a C-clamp on the outside and ram them into each other, you look down that waveguide, it's the ugliest looking thing in the world. You think that waveguide has got to be mirror smooth, silver plated, and no edges that you can see. And here you're making a great big jump in transition from one size to another. You do that, and you end up with a 1.4 standing wave ratio. It works. You say to yourself, what in the world's going on here? And you drill a couple of holes in the waveguide, whichever one you like, and you put a couple of screws in there, and you adjust the screws to the right length, and you can correct that VizLaw and bring it down to 1.05 if you want to, at your favorite frequency. And you can tune out the transition, even though to your eye it looks ugly as all hell. The next thing you can do is that you take two pieces of WR90 and don't bother screwing them together. Hold them on the outside with some kind of a C-clamp-like device and twist one with respect to the other so that they don't line up correctly. And you twist them about 30 degrees and it looks ugly as all hell. And again, you end up with a 1.4 standing wave ratio that you can tune out with screws if you want to. A new person using waveguides makes the assumption that all kinds of extreme accuracy are required. That wave is as blind as a bat. You'd be amazed what kind of murder you can get away with. You can take a round piece of pipe and ram it into the end of that WR90 square waveguide and fill in the empty space with whatever kind of metallic object you want to, tinfoil or whatever, and make sure that, you know, it's held in one position and not wiggling. And again, put in some tuning screws, and you can make the transition between the two have a 1.05 standing wave ratio. I personally have built a WR90 to 3/4 inch water pipe waveguide transition by simply taking the 3/4 inch water pipe and with vise and tools slowly ramming it into round at one end and rectangular WR90 at the other end. And I've got a very precise directional coupler, which allows me to measure reflectivity down to minus 50 dB relative. Let me drop. And just by doing that very simple transition, I had a 30 dB reflection coefficient. That's something like a 1.05 is worth, if I remember. So, very simple mechanical techniques to give you the transition between the two. So, that chaparral horn that you took apart, that you saw the two different feed whiskers down at the end of it. One launches clockwise, one launches counterclockwise, because there is a polarizing device built into that round waveguide, which most likely you're going to remove, or you're going to use it at right angles so that it's ineffective. That polarizing device is at a 45-degree angle to either one of those launching probes. One of those probes, by the way, is the clockwise, one's the counterclockwise. And how do they switch between the two in the low-noise lockdown converter? They don't. There is a low-noise preamplifier on the clockwise, there is a low-noise preamplifier on the counterclockwise, and the two of them run simultaneously. You just choose whichever output you want, if you want clockwise or counterclockwise, meaning that your system is smart enough to know it's on an odd channel that you've selected or an even channel. And so for you to use that probe that's already there, and maybe even use that preamplifier that's already there, you may, so many guys have done that. You have to get rid of a bandpass filter in some cases, but to use the horn that was already on it, and to for you to form your own launching structure into that almost 3/4 inch, it's less than 3/4 inch pipe that's there. For you to create your own launching probe into that pipe is one way to go, or you can take your favorite WR90 or WR75 waveguide coax adapter and adapt between the two. The choice is yours. Just a matter of how much fiddling you want to do by which process. In either case, you can make that feed on, have an extremely low VizLaw into space, and when you launch it into, when you aim it into your offset dish, the nice thing about offset is that almost none of the energy hitting the dish reflects back to the horn. Therefore, in that particular case,
the horn in front of the dish doesn't change its visuar. Whereas an ordinary full parabola prime fed system, when you mount the horn in front of the dish, you get a brand new visuar that's got to be recorrected. You don't have that problem. Your problem, Glenn, is you've got more choices than you would like to have, and you're going to have to decide which one's the best for you. KC2QI2, KQRIW on the TechNet.
Yeah, it's a very good point. As a matter of fact, I'm very happy to hear what you said about using that, because actually the construction of that little aluminum or hot metal material that comes out where the antenna just leaves the other board, I did look at the circuitry and I measured it, and then I removed the printed circuit board that was coming out to the two F connectors underneath the bottom with the preamplifiers on the receive, and I saw the two whiskers, the left hand and the right hand, that were running underneath there, and I took some measurements on it. Then I removed the circuit board, which removed the two left-hand, right-hand whisker antennas at the very end toward the back. And what I saw there is that, yes, now it's a square flange on the back, and I could cut it away and drill holes. But I was just wondering just how to make the adapter. And I think, as you pointed out, it's really just a matter of measuring it and seeing which is going to actually give me the best performance. Thanks for allowing me to take up some of your time, Dick. But you've definitely answered all my questions that I needed here for tonight. K2RIW, KC2QIQ. Thanks, Ken.
And hopefully when you're operational on 10 gigs a month or two or three from now, if all goes well, I'd like to hope that I'm going to be operational, Bruce and 2LIV, and Wisconsin will be operational. I believe that one time Mel, KC2KEY, is operational on 10 gigs, and he's a guy who can build things in a very short period of time. So with enough enthusiasm, he can become operational, and we can put 10 gigs back on the map. When it comes to the last 10 gig contests that are held in August and September every year for the last 15 years, for quite a few of those years, the New York City, New Jersey, Long Island area, Connecticut area, was one of the hot spots where a lot of activity on the East Coast was taking place. For the last couple of years, because Bruce and I are off and the other guys on Long Island lost some enthusiasm, all of a sudden there's a black hole in this high-tech area. And the guys in Boston who are very active, and the guys in Virginia who are quite active, and the guys in Texas who are very active, and the guys in California who are very active, and the guys in Chicago and Michigan who are very active, they're saying, what the hell happened to Long Island? So those guys dig a hole and pull the hole in after them? And to a degree, we did. And we have to put ourselves back on the map. This is supposedly a high-tech microwave area, and it's not being well represented, and we got to do something about that. So, Mel, Dick, Glenn, and Bruce, it's about time we get on our horse and start getting back into the race. Okay, who have I forgotten? Is there anyone else I forgot of the people who signed into the TechNet tonight? Give me a call, letters and name right now. K2RIW in the TechNet.
WS Glenn for a space report, Dick.
Yeah, it's about time we have a space report. Okay, who is it that just said you had a question?
Excuse me, WB7ADF. I'm not trying to be mundane because this is all very fascinating, but I do have some comments and questions.
Okay, I think it was ABF, and I maybe wrote it down as ABS before. I think it's Rob. Oh, yes, you had a question. Oh, another guy has skipped over. Go right ahead, sir. And after that, we're going to go to a space report. You got it, Rob.
Hey, nice to see you guys all. Believe me, this is all very intriguing, fascinating stuff. I don't want to belabor you with my mundane question and commentary, so if you want to go over the space report, fine, do it. Otherwise, it's just a report on my RFI problems in the apartment and questions about software for analyzing antennas for a guy who's not really techie, and questions about what you think about the MIT University's online electronic courses. So, if this stuff's relevant, we'll go ahead. If not, by all means, I'm on the side. WB7AVF Portable 2.
Okay, is that Whiskey Bravo 7 Alpha Victor Foxtrot? Do I have that correct, Rob?
You do. How's the audio?
Perfect audio. Go right ahead with your question and or report.
Okay, guys, nice. I got a lot of fascinating resonance on many levels. Gentlemen, guys, good evening. Good evening, Dick. WB7ABF is the call here at Seattle License, EXE1DT, Bravo 10 in Mexico, and living in New York. Anyway, After hearing all the questions fielded, I'm a CW operator, a musician, by the way, and without apology, I kind of told you guys it's art lives from France, from Mars. Anyway, hope you guys enjoy the beautiful sunny day we've had here. But my RFI problem I've had some time back was resolved, as you recall, 2 weeks ago, when I recommended to neighbor that he get some beads. I won't mention his name you have, but he did that. Seems to have improved the situation, but not completely, you know, because, again, consumer electronics are not completely stable. And I have a question in terms of antenna modeling, okay? Two questions, actually. I'm new to that. I can download some programs, but I want to be able to incorporate metal fence that's on my rooftop. I have an old optimized dipole up at 90 feet, and I'd like to find some way to model that fence. It's not loaded up. But in terms of modeling my antenna performance, because I'm thinking about putting up a big loop up there, and talk to you guys with some ideas for software, instructional videos, online stuff that's available for guys who want to learn about how you use modeling software. It's oftentimes pretty complex. And the other question was, what do you think about Anandaga wires that might be electronic courses online or just from MIT? Very, theoretically very engaging and very interesting. And personally, I found it very appealing. We talked about a lot of theory, circuit charts, and all that kind of stuff. Hope it hasn't been too much, and I hope I haven't dealt with you. Back.
Plugged in the wrong microphone. Okay, Rob. I think your QTH is New York City on 160th Street, and when you talk about 90 feet up, I presume you're talking about a rooftop installation on the ninth floor, and I think you're saying there's a fence around the edge, and I think you want to know how to model the metal fence, and whether or not the metal fence has to be modeled is, a function, are you operating on VHF, SHF, or HF, frequency region. The fence is probably not there when you're on 40 meters, but on 10 gigahertz, yeah, the fence is there, although most likely you're going to put your 10 gig antenna above the fence. So you're going to have to give me a couple more words as to what you have in mind, what frequency range. And the fence, I presume, is something around the perimeter of the roof to stop people from falling off the roof. I'm presuming you've also got the use of the roof for your antenna range and or antenna farm, is what I'm thinking. So give me a couple more words there, because maybe I'm way off in left field on this one, Rob. Go ahead. My name is Dick.
Yeah, very well, Dick. Thanks a lot. Yes, absolutely. And my intuition was the same, having read that it wasn't relevant at HF frequencies. Indeed, it's not. So this is great. Yeah, I'm running HF, basically, you know, 160 through 10, and that's it. And I'm not running 10 gigahertz, so I guess it's not relevant. And I wanted to know how I could put up a loop, and if the loop was affected by it, attaching the pulse structures to that loop, to that fence.
Okay, you're very lucky. You just happen to have a loop expert on frequency tonight. On frequency every Sunday night. Meaning Mel, K2KDY. I'm going to pass it over to him in a minute. Because he has only spent the last 2 or 3 years of his life doing loop experiments, and maybe longer than that. And some of what he's come up with is a little bit controversial. It's opposite of common sense, and people are giving him a little bit of flack. But for those who have got the leap of faith and duplicate what he does, they say, yeah, he's right. And it really does do that. Who cares if the common sense says it's wrong? Now, when it comes to fence and other kinds of obstructions, if you're putting on your RF eyeglasses, the first thing you look at when you look at an obstruction is how big is it in the wavelength of the frequency you're using. If I'm on the 40-meter band, where the wavelength is in the vicinity of 130 feet, and that fence is only 8 foot high, 8 feet out of 130 is such a small fraction of a wavelength, it can't do much. It's not much of a shield. If you're using that fence as a shield, it's going to shield the signal that goes from point A to point B by 1 dB. If you were a radar expert and you look at a fence that is
a tenth of a wavelength high. It's going to give you an echo, but not a very big one. So when you look at objects that are potentially going to disturb your signal, the first thing to consider is what are the wavelengths. If I'm on 10 gigahertz, where the wavelength is 1 inch, and if this fence was made out of a solid sheet of metal, and it's 8 foot high, my goodness, is that a significant reflector. If it's a chain link fence on 40 meters, whether it be a solid sheet of metal or chain link, it's identical, because the holes in the chain link fence are such a small fraction of a wavelength that every one of them is what we call waveguide beyond cutoff. Very similar to if I was building a screen that I put in front of a water tap, and if I make the holes in the screen 1/10 millionth of an inch in diameter, not very much water is going to flow through them. Well, the RF behaves somewhat like that. When the holes in your screening are very...